Welcome to the 108th episode of Admissions Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you get to that delightful instant when you can high-five the person next to you and shout, "Yes, I'm in." Our guest today is an entrepreneur and social innovator who founded an organization with a mission of creating 100,000 new jobs by 2025. He has been honored by the White House as a champion of change and actually met with President Obama. He fervently believes that entrepreneurship is the means to economic growth, not just for the technological elite in Silicon Valley, Boston, or Los Angeles, but the path to prosperity and growth throughout the United States, and my guess is the rest of the world too. He is also the author of Smart People Should Build Things, How to Restore Our Culture of Achievement, Build a Path for Entrepreneurs, and Create New Jobs in America. Before I dive into our conversation with today's guest, I want to remind you, listeners, that I invite your questions. If you have an admissions-related question, just go to the show notes at info.accepted.com/108 and post your question in a comment. You can also send me questions via email at questions@accepted.com. If your question is chosen, I'll ask and answer it on the show. Now to our guest, Andrew Yang. Andrew is a graduate of Brown University and NYU Law. He practiced law briefly and then moved to the startup scene. Some of you may remember Andrew best as the CEO of Manhattan GMAT from 2006 to 2011, which is how I first met him. And then in 2011, he sold Manhattan GMAT to the Washington Post, Kaplan. In 2011, he founded Venture for America, which we'll learn more about in just a minute. And in 2014, he published Smart People Should Build Things, which we will also discuss. Andrew, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
Thanks for having me, Linda. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm so glad you can join me. Now, what is Venture for America?
Venture for America is a nonprofit that recruits and trains college graduates from around the U.S. that want to be entrepreneurs. If you're accepted into Venture for America, we bring you to a five-week training camp with McKinsey and IDEO and other top firms and entrepreneurs, and then you go work for 2 years at an existing startup with a more experienced entrepreneur in a city that could use an economic boost. Right now we operate in Providence, Detroit, Baltimore, St. Louis, New Orleans, and 10 other U.S. cities. And at the end of the 2 years, if you want to start your own business, we have an accelerator and seed fund, and I'm happy to say that 25% of our alums have started businesses within the 2 years, and an additional 60% have become managers and leaders at the startups that they were placed at or another company. So you can think of it as a nationwide entrepreneurship apprenticeship program.
That's a great way to look at it and describe it. Now, of the 75% that didn't start immediately, do you think many will come back or have already, you know, especially for your first class? There would be 2 years in between now and when they finished. Did many of them start later, or do you know if they intend to start their own business later?
Oh, very much so. I mean, the 25% is essentially at the completion of the program. But entrepreneurs often, as you know, start businesses after years of experience. I believe the average age of an entrepreneur in the U.S. is around 39 years old, according to the Kauffman Foundation. So we fully expect that over time, the proportion of Venture for America alums that start a business is only going to rise. Though I would caution that we are not of the opinion that everything is about the founder, that if you're the person who helps a company grow and reach its potential, that's just as important, and each company needs a lot of those people as well. So it's not all about founding a company.
It's true. Can you tell us how you came to found Venture for America? Give us a little bit of the backstory.
Well, sure, and you know, I interact a lot with recent college graduates, so I remember that time. So when I graduated from Brown in the mid-90s, I didn't know what to do, and so I went to law school really out of a default option mentality than anything else. And I found that law school was not a great fit for me. I actually went to Columbia. I think you had me coming from someplace else.
Sorry, I think I had you at NYU. Sorry about that. I got it from somewhere.
No worries.
Okay.
But I practiced law and didn't find it to be a good fit. And this is after, obviously, a very high investment in law school. So then I went and tried to start my own business as a 25-year-old, and I found it to be excruciatingly difficult, so difficult that my company flopped and went out of business when the bubble burst. So at this point, I was 26. I just lost investors, $250,000 or so. I still owed $100K in law school debt. And the question was, like, what happens then? And how do you develop as an entrepreneur?
Was that the dot-com bubble at that point?
When the dot-com bubble burst.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I worked with a more experienced entrepreneur for 4 years, and I learned that way. And then I became the head of Manhattan GMAT, which years later was acquired by the Washington Post. So during that time, I got a lot of exposure to how hard it is to start a business and how much working with a more experienced mentor can help you. I also was highly exposed to many young people that were heading toward paths like law school, like I did, without a real clear direction or mission as to why they were doing it. It's just because they thought that was the way they're going to become successful and reach their goals. And so I thought if we had a directed path and include a very high apprenticeship and mentorship element for aspiring entrepreneurs, we could help the young people, we could help our economy and society and our country get back to where it wants to be.
Great. Now, I understand the mission of Venture for America is to create 100,000 jobs in the United States by 2025. How far along are you to reaching that goal?
Well, at last count, our partner companies and our fellow founded companies have created about 1,200 plus jobs, like 1,210 or something like that.
Okay.
Which we're very excited and proud of. I mean, it's obviously about 99,000 away from 100,000. But, you know, the way these curves work is that as our companies grow and prosper and as our fellows mature, we think we can make really significant inroads and a dent in that 100,000 in the next 10 years.
My husband is a mathematician, and he was always very dismissive of my understanding of calculus because I took the minimum. I took the absolute minimum I could get away with. And one day we were talking, and this was shortly after we met, got married, and he was trying to explain to me that something was going to increase at an increasing rate. And he somehow was getting a little frustrated. And I said, yeah, I got it. The second derivative is positive. And he just broke up laughing. So I think what you're trying to say is that with your growth, the second derivative will be positive. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay.
The curve of the curve is only going to go up.
That's right.
And also the number of fellows is going to go up. All of the inputs are only going to accelerate.
That's right. And regardless of whether you reach that goal or not, whether you end up with 100 or 150 or 50, 1,000 new jobs, it'll be that many more jobs than there would have been without it. So, I think you're smart to take pride in what you've accomplished and just keep aiming for what is admittedly a rather audacious goal. Now,
Between you and me, the goal was less audacious until some board member said, hey, let's get more aggressive. And then I shrugged and said, okay.
Okay.
So, we're also not that wedded to the number of the benchmark.
Well, I also got to tell you that when I was attended last year an information session at Stanford GSB, and the speaker, an admissions officer, said that what they really love is really awesome, audacious goals. Go for it. Now, what does it take to become a Venture for America fellow?
Well, we take recent college graduates, so people typically apply as either a senior in college or 1 to 3 years after graduation. And we're looking for people that certainly have the potential to maybe start a company down the road, but also to help a company grow. So it's not that you necessarily need to have founding experience, so to speak. We're looking for a young person that has demonstrated high capacities in a particular area that we think would translate into early stage businesses. So that could be very good at school. Obviously, technical training could be considered a plus. But it also could mean that they were great and at an athletic pursuit and showed like a ton of perseverance and self-development. It could be that they started an organization or club or a charitable campaign that showed a lot of leadership. It could be that they worked in student-run businesses throughout their college career. It could be that they were just excellent at some academic pursuit that at first blush might not seem like it would relate to business. For example, we have art history and anthropology majors in Venture for America that have been very successful, with the thought being that if you're really exceptional at something, then you can be exceptional at other things as well that require a degree of determination and perseverance.
Seems also like initiative is very, very important.
Yes. Another aspect of what we're looking for is very much a character piece where we're investing a lot of resources but also time and heart and sweat in these young people. And so we're looking for people that genuinely want to have a positive impact in the world and want to have careers that positively reflect their values.
Great. Now, what do Venture for America fellows do during the 2 years? You mentioned the 5-week boot camp. What happens after that?
Well, even throughout and before the 5-week boot camp, they interview with companies around the country. Mm-hmm. And so right now we have about 200 job openings with 125 fellows, so it's competitive on the company side as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll join an early-stage company, and typically the company will have between 5 and 35 employees, though we do have some outliers at either end of that range. And they'll join as anything from chief of staff to the CEO to entry-level analyst programmer to business development to community manager to content creator / communications lead, depending upon what the company needs and wants. And our fellows have such different profiles that during the matching process, they'll submit themselves as, let's say, a new marketing hire. And of the 200 companies, a couple dozen of them will be looking for a marketing lead. Perhaps you might even be the first marketing hire because the core team just consists of engineers at that point. So the roles are varied, with the goal being that they have a potential positive impact for both the company and also for the individual as a professional development opportunity.
Now, you mentioned that it's two questions are coming to mind as we're speaking. Are most of the fellows going into technology-related startups, or does it vary in terms of industry? That's one question. And you mentioned college grads or up to, let's say, 3 years out. What about people who are in graduate school? Maybe they're pursuing a master's. Maybe they're ABD, you know, all but the dissertation and a PhD program. Are they eligible for Venture for America? I realize those are two very different questions.
Sure. So to the second question, we do have master's graduates who do decide that getting a PhD is not a good fit for them, and they apply to Venture for America and have worked out phenomenally well.
Okay.
So
great.
It certainly – and those people, again, it's like, hey – what do they know about startups? It's like, well, look, if you're getting a master's in a certain discipline, you're probably very bright at something. And, you know, if you come through our process, we trust that you'll be able to contribute. To the first question, a slight majority of the companies are tech or tech-related or tech-enabled, but a lot of them are not. There's one company in Cincinnati called Rheingeist that's a microbrewery that has grown by dozens of employees, and we have a fellow there. There are nonprofits that are doing tremendous work that also we think are good growth opportunities. For example, Idea Village in New Orleans is an entrepreneurship nonprofit, and we've had two fellows there. So there are all sorts of different types of operations. Not all of them are straight-up tech, internet, et cetera. I'm happy to say they are very diverse, the businesses, and even in some cases the nonprofits.
Okay, great. And what happens when fellows leave Venture for America? What do they do? You mentioned 25% immediately start their own companies. Okay. What about the other 75%? Do some of them decide they want to pursue an MBA? Do they just go take jobs? Is it varied as people are varied? I mean, is there any typical?
Sure. So 25% are starting their own companies, which we think is tremendous.
Sure.
We do have an accelerator and seed fund to invest in them. So if someone wants to be an entrepreneur, this is a genuine path to do so. I always thought, you know, you can't talk about it. You have to put some money to work. So we've invested hundreds of thousands and our fellows have hired dozens of other employees and raised at this point, I think it's around $2 million in addition to anything we've done. So that's 25%.
Right.
An additional 40% or so are managers and leaders at the company that they were placed at or another company in a VFA city. So you're looking at two-thirds that are either manager, leader at a startup or started their own company. And then of the remaining 35%, about 20% have gone to work in startups in a non-VFA city, typically either San Francisco or New York. And then we have a few people that are heading to graduate school. So one's at Stanford GSB, one's at London School of Economics. And we have a very long time horizons. It's certainly not that you think someone necessarily has to start a company in their mid-20s or whatnot. Though I do want to say, and that this is something about our mission, that entrepreneurship in the United States among 18 to 30-year-olds is at a 24-year low.
Really?
Like all the hype you might see.
Yeah, that a lot of hype.
There's a lot of hype, but if you see the data, it's very clear and it's quite distressing. And that's from the Federal Reserve, McKinsey, and the Kaufman Foundation. They all agree that entrepreneurship among 18 to 30-year-olds is much lower now than it's been historically.
Okay. Because I know GMAC recently, I wonder if people are perhaps postponing entrepreneurship a little bit more than they used to, because GMAC recently started reporting entrepreneurial goals as almost a separate category in its reporting, in its most recent, applicant report or corporate recruiter survey report, some very, very recent GMAC report that was separating it out.
I think entrepreneurial goals are quite high, Linda. I mean, mm-hmm. We meet people all the time. Entrepreneurship education programs have quadrupled around the country.
Right.
But actual entrepreneurship has actually declined. And, there are a number of reasons for it. Indebtedness from educational
loans, sure.
Debt is certainly among the reasons that gets cited.
Major.
Yeah, so there's a high interest, but a low yield and low execution, and that's actually quite consistent with the things I see. I work with entrepreneurship clubs and colleges around the country, and it's very, very rare that one of those people in the entrepreneurship club is actually starting a business out of college. Much more often, it's a resume item, and they're applying for, banking consulting jobs typically.
But isn't that part of the – in other words, you started a business right out of law school, and it didn't go so well. Are those people maybe just saying, I need some experience, I need some training before I start my own business?
Quite possibly. And that's certainly one of the reasons why we think what Venture for America provides is so vital, because you need some experience. Typically, you need a bit of a network, you need some connections, you need support structure. I don't have any issues with a 22-year-old coming out of college who wants to be an entrepreneur who takes a job. That's probably what they should do. Like 95% of the time plus, maybe 99% of the time plus. Because starting a business is brutally difficult. And starting a business as a 22-year-old, you're probably elevating the level of difficulty even higher, given that most businesses fail within a certain time frame. I think it's like 3 years or so most businesses have failed.
Right.
So certainly, I don't think that most 22-year-olds are well served by starting a company. They should take a job. They should get experience. I think that the thing that I'm after is trying to present an accurate picture of what things look like on the ground for young people who are interested in entrepreneurship, which is that it's not somehow more accessible and easier than it's ever been. It's actually more rare than it's been historically.
Okay. Now, can you tell us, I'd love to hear a success story from Venture for America that you are particularly proud of. Could you share one?
Sure. So there's a fellow who joined us in 2012. His name is Brian Rudolph. He grew up in Westchester, New York, went to Emory University, studied finance, had an offer from a consulting firm and was set to take it, found out about Venture for America, applied, got in, and then we brought him to training camp, and then he went to Detroit and worked at an e-commerce company there. And he was in a sales role, so he was doing a lot of selling. And on the side, he was looking for health food options, and in Detroit there weren't a lot. So he made himself a pasta out of chickpeas in his kitchen and kept working on it. It's high-protein, gluten-free pasta, I know. So would you believe that today Bonza pasta is now distributed in hundreds of stores around the U.S., including ShopRite, Eataly, Meijer, has raised $1.3 million and has hired 25 people to make the pasta in suburban Michigan.
Wow.
And is off to the races. It's a high-protein, gluten-free pasta that, you know, you can eat guilt-free and it's nutritionally much, much better.
Have you tried it? Is it good? Is it tasty?
It is tasty. My two-year-old likes it. You can swap it out for normal pasta, put some sauce on it, and then you feel much better as a parent. So, you know, and again, he's 24 years old, has 25 employees, raised over $1 million, and it's a real strong business where, you know, every day someone's discovering it on a grocery store shelf. So it just goes to show what a young person's capable of if you put them in a certain environment and you support them actually starting a business. One of the jokes I tell, but it's pretty accurate, and this is from my experience, if you're a young person, you don't know what to do, and you apply to, you say, hey, I want to go to law school,
yeah.
It's easy to find. Your parents will think it's a great idea, and the government will give you a $100,000 loan, essentially no questions asked.
Yeah, but you got to pay that loan back. But you got to pay that loan back.
Yeah, you do, but they'll give it to you.
Yeah.
If you want to start a business, it's hard to find. Your parents will think it's a terrible idea, and no one's going to give you a $100,000 loan. And so we're structurally encouraging things that we don't necessarily need more of as a society, given that – so Bloomberg Business Week projects tens of thousands of unemployed and underemployed law school graduates between now and 2020. But we're structurally encouraging that. And then what we want is more entrepreneurs starting companies like Bonza and places like Detroit. But that's extraordinarily difficult, particularly if you're an achievement-oriented young person. And so our argument is that we need to dedicate resources to the things that we want to see and not just the things that, you know, have been in effect for decades.
Well, that kind of leads me to my next question, that comment. Why did you write Smart People Should Build Things?
You know, for a very practical reason, I wrote it because I started a nonprofit, and it turns out if you start a nonprofit, you spend time telling people about your nonprofit a fair amount, and then you realize, hey, if I wrote it down, then maybe someone could find out about it without, you know, being there.
A friend of mine called his book one of a very expensive business card.
Yeah, there was a review that came out when the book was published, and it said it was positive, the review, but then it said this book could be considered a thinly veiled promotional vehicle for Yang's organization.
Uh-huh.
And then I laughed and said, like, what's the veil? Like, I thought it was clear that. So it was very much a utilitarian move on my part. You know, I consider myself an operator. And so it turns out on the nonprofit side, if you want to grow your organization, you need to spread the ideas behind the organization. So that's why I wrote the book.
Okay. Yeah, and I think you effectively did that. Now, you argue in the book that society would be better off and everyone would be more prosperous if, A, gifted people built businesses as opposed to working for services firms, be they law firms, financial services firms, or consultancies. And B, the entrepreneurship benefits people in smaller cities as well as in major entrepreneurial centers like Silicon Valley, Boston, New York, and Los Angeles. So, okay, and we were talking a bit about this before the call. Let's pretend now that I am a recent grad, college or grad school, and I'm looking forward to the money, the training, the lifestyle of a consultant or investment banker or highly paid professional. Why should I become a scrappy, struggling entrepreneur? What are the benefits to the individual of entrepreneurship? You argued in the book about the advantages to society, but what about the advantages to the entrepreneur? It's hard. You're not going to have money showered on you. Why do it?
Well, you know, and you could speak to this question yourself, Linda, as an entrepreneur who's built a business, and it's
so have you. So have you. Come on.
And it certainly takes a while. But... you know, I had an advantage when answering this kind of question, which was that I went to law school and became a corporate attorney and was there for not very long, but long enough to know it was not for me. And so the things you cite about – actually, so I'll tell you a story. I was at my job, and I didn't really like it. And I was like, why am I doing this job? And I was like, I guess it's because they pay me a lot of money. And so I said, okay, so what does money buy you? So then I went to Bloomingdale's and bought a bunch of stuff and to see if it would, like, float my boat or get me excited. And it really didn't. And then I went home and was like, I should really reevaluate things.
things don't make you happy.
Well, so if someone really is like, I'm all about the money, then it could be that entrepreneurship is not the best route, because I would argue that entrepreneurship is probably not the best risk-adjusted way to make as much money as possible in most situations, unless you're just an incredible entrepreneur. So it depends upon your goals. I think that for someone who does have a yearning or a hankering or an impulse to build something and become an entrepreneur, that process will end up shaping you into a particular type of person, the same way that being a corporate attorney will shape you into a particular type of person, or being a banker or a trader will shape you into a different sort of person. And a lot of it is just about what kind of person you want to be, and whether you're okay with grappling with a process as well as an outcome. Mm-hmm. And by that I mean, like, when you start on down a road trying to build a business, you can't know exactly how it's going to turn out. And certainly if I were advising someone, I would not say, hey, do this if you must be successful at a certain time frame. What I would say to that person is, like, do this if you want to become the kind of person that is capable of building and leading a business, because there's no other way to do that than to build and lead a business. I mean, it's about, in my opinion, an experience. It's about as much a personal journey and what you value as a human as it is some kind of financial outcome. And for me, when I left the law, I took a big pay cut. My company flopped. You know, like, I didn't make as much money for years. But to me, the struggle was about looking in the mirror and saying, like, hey, like, I'm doing stuff I value and care about. I work with people I admire. And those are the things that are important to me, much more so than, you know, how much I get to spend on dinner tonight and whether I get to expense it. Like, it turns out to me those things were not that important.
Right. For me, it was more about having work that I enjoyed that I could manage around my family life when I started Accepted. At the time, I had 6 young children. They're all grown now. Well, my kids are grown.
I didn't know that, Linda. That's a very large brood. I've got one 2-year-old son and another on the way in August, so I'm slowly catching up to you.
You gotta catch up to me, But well, good. Congratulations on both of them, basically. But So anyway, that was for me. That was the paramount driver at the time, because at the time also, you know, if I went to work, it almost would have certainly meant, you know, 9 to 5 or 9 to whatever, out of the house and that kind of stuff. And I didn't want that. So.
That's a whole other conversation around entrepreneurship among women, right, underrepresented minorities, and others that might not necessarily find a perfect fit culturally with large corporate environments. I think that can certainly be a spur to entrepreneurship for many.
Right. Actually, my personal opinion is that it's something that's underrated and not talked about enough. But that's another conversation. Now, what do you think? You obviously went to law school. You were very much involved in business school admissions. Do you feel that grad school can benefit entrepreneurs, that an MBA is useful for entrepreneurs? What's your take on that one? That's an ongoing debate.
Well, it's something that works out very well for some people in some situations. Like, there are some very successful entrepreneurs that I know that went to business schools. Mm-hmm. And then for others, you know, they'd be probably better served by taking that money and time and going directly after an opportunity. I think it's very much an individual determination. Mm-hmm. I would say systemically that typically getting, because if you go to business school, let's say, you're going to end up with $100,000 in debt probably, and some multiple of that in opportunity costs oftentimes. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really large commitment. I joke sometimes that I would have much less issue with business schools and law school if they were free. Then I'd be like, hey, everyone have at it. But as it is, advancing yourself 2 to 3 years and loading up on $100,000 plus in debt is typically not going to make you more risk tolerant. It's typically going to make you a little bit more risk averse, a little bit older. Mm-hmm. I used to joke about my law school debt as my mistress because I was sending it a check every month, reporting like what I thought was like a phantom family somewhere. So the debt is real. The debt does end up impinging on your flexibility in various ways, and it's something that you can't know until after you experience it.
Okay. Now, you argued a minute ago that, you know, again, related to your book more and the comments you made before we mentioned the book, was that we as a society are misallocating resources by sending our best and brightest seemingly into consultancies, investment banking, to a lesser extent law at this point. How should society, given that we do not live in a society, fortunately, in my opinion, that, you know, that directs people into particular paths or commands people to pursue particular paths, how should society encourage investment and entrepreneurship, and not just financial investment, but people investment, sweat investment?
Sure. So I think the first thing is we need to present more diverse visions of success to our young people. I think someone like you who's built a thriving business on your own terms would be a phenomenal role model. Like, how many
Thank
people
you.
Know that that's a potential path? I do think a lot of it does boil down to resources. So, and as you know, we're very much inspired by Teach for America here at, mm-hmm. at BFA.
Mm-hmm.
So Teach for America had 50,000 applicants for 5,000 spots in the last year record, but they spent $38 million on recruitment and selection. So it's not like the 50,000 just sort of woke up one day and said, hey, let me apply to Teach for America. And of Teach for America's $220 million annual budget, about $80 million of it's federally funded. So the federal government's already involved in these issues, mm-hmm. directing its talent to certain places, certain pursuits. And in the absence of the ability to curb spending on the part of certain people, you know, to me, it is a matter of investing in what you want to see happen. So, you know, I joke sometimes about, like, what could someone have done to keep me from going to law school years ago? And the best thing that someone can do, you can't argue negatively. You have to argue positively. You have to say, like, hey, we want you to do this, and we'll invest in that choice. We can't say don't do that, because then you don't leave someone with a legitimate alternative. I joke sometimes that it's like we have a menu for our young people, and we say, here are the six things we want you to do. And then what we really want you to do is the seventh thing we're hiding behind our back, and we make it obscure and difficult. And that doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
What we want to do is, if you know that certain choices are going to be made conspicuously available because of tens of millions of dollars getting spent every year, then you have to bring in a legitimate alternative and dedicate the resources to make it possible.
So you would advocate just, I guess, more government support and more publicity surrounding entrepreneurship and specifically options like Venture for America, Teach for America, et cetera, correct?
Well, so one of the great things about Teach for America is it's shown how powerful the non-monetary drivers are.
Right.
So prestige, community, training, optionality, pro-social. These things are all things that young people care about. They care about them as much or more than money. And so if someone says, hey, why does someone go to Wall Street? People think it must be the money. But it's also about the fact that it's prestigious, you're doing it with friends, you'll gain a network and options if you decide you don't want to do it forever. You know, it'll look good on your resume, your parents like it. Like, there are all these things that are not explicitly financial, that are kind of related. And it turns out that you can provide, like Venture for America, we had 1,600 applications for 125 spots this past year for jobs that at least start typically at 40K in Baltimore and St. Louis. I mean, these are not so, but you can tell there's demand because it's prestigious, it's an incredible network and community. We will train you. You will have options afterwards. You know, it is good for the country, and it's pro-social. So we need to leverage more of those factors to direct our talent in meaningful ways and get beyond the dollars and cents, because I'm happy to say that young people are motivated by more than that.
Right, right. And even older adults are. How should...
Yes, agreed. Agreed, Linda, agreed. I certainly don't mean to curb that. That's what drives me personally, is just this passion and certainty that we have so much energy and talent that is being underutilized and misallocated right now, that if we can get more of it to the right spots, then the sky's the limit.
How should either the student in college or grad school, or perhaps a recent grad working for a large corporation, be it a consulting firm, a financial services firm, or somewhere in corporate America, how should that person prepare themselves for entrepreneurship if they feel that that is ultimately their path? So they'd like to
sure.
experience or try out.
Yes. Well, the first thing I'd advise is to try and keep your personal burn rate under control, because it's much harder to be an entrepreneur if you just need lots of money in your paycheck every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And so that can include obligations that aren't just yours personally, but, you know, for, like, those that might rely on you. The second thing is that there are a lot of things you can do even while holding down a job that will help steer you in this direction. So let's say you have a job, let's call it, like, 9 to 6 or 9 to 6:30. You can still find companies in your community or region that are doing interesting things and just say, hey, let me help out, or let me try and make introductions on your behalf. If you work with them and spend more time with them, then you'll build relationships and you'll start seeing opportunities where you certainly wouldn't have otherwise. It's a significant commitment, but it's something that I've seen lead to people getting involved with startups in cities around the country. And the other thing really is to try and, if it's not networking in your off hours, to dedicate a significant amount of time in your off hours to another pursuit. I say this because things are very unlikely just to come find you. You're going to need to invest some time and energy and sweat equity in either developing yourself or developing your network to a point where you'll see things outside of your corporate. Because for the most part, headhunters are not going to come to you.
Okay. In your view, and this is probably going to be our last question, is entrepreneurship a state of mind, a perspective, or is it an activity, or is it a skill? Maybe that should have been my first question. I don't know.
The first thing I'd say is that entrepreneurship is something you can 100% get better at and learn.
Sure.
I'm very much not of the school where it's like you're somehow born with it or not, or it's innate. I was not an entrepreneurial young person, I would say. And
mm-hmm.
I guess I've developed into something of one.
For sure. Absolutely.
And at this point. So entrepreneurship is defined as the pursuit of an opportunity without regard for resources currently under your control. That is, you see something that needs to be built, or a service or an offering. You don't have everything at your disposal just to make it happen, so you have to go out and get them. And it complicates your life because you have to do two things at once. One, get the resources, and then two, deploy them and operate in a way that actually capitalizes on the opportunity that you see.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is an activity, but it's an activity that you get better at the more you pursue it, because you have a better sense as to what it takes to get something done. You have different sorts of connections. You hang out with different kind of people. So it's just an activity. It is, to me, and not to wax spiritual on this, but it's something that can, like, that can elevate people and their capacities. Because if you're within a structure and say, hey, you know, here's what you need to do to get an A, a lot of people can do that. But for the person to get to a point where they can actually bring something new into the world, it's a little bit like parenting, I suppose, though,
mm-hmm.
you know, less
mm-hmm.
biological on that. And you know, hopefully the kid, you know, the kid won't expire on you the way that the businesses can. But it leads to an elevated sense of capacities and what's possible and what you are capable of. So it's one of the reasons why I love trying to drive people towards entrepreneurship, because I think it brings out the best in them.
That's great. Andrew, thank you so much for joining me today. This conversation has been absolutely fascinating. Where can listeners learn more about Venture for America and your book?
Well, certainly the book's available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all that. It's called Smart People Should Build Things. VentureForAmerica.org is our website. We do have an active podcast for those of you who like podcasts. It's called Smart People Should Build Things and on social media. But we are a vital, real organization. Our budget this year is $5 million, and we hope to grow it. Our goal is to make it so that entrepreneurship is a viable path for young people in this country. So please do, if you find this interesting at all, please do follow up and check us out.
Okay. Listener, you'll find links in the show notes at info.exhibit.com/108. And we'll link both to Venture for America and Andrew's book. And not just both, we'll link to all three. We'll also link to the podcast. And I do recommend Andrew's book. I thought it was quite interesting. So thanks again.
Thank you, Linda. Congratulations on thriving and being so successful over these past years. It makes me very happy to see.
Thank you. Listener, thank you, too, for tuning in to this, our 108th episode. Now for an announcement and a request. First, the announcement. We want to inform you that we have a special for Mission Straight Talk listeners, 10% off any non-rush service purchased by June 30th. This discount may not be combined with any other discount offer at Accepted. The coupon code is AST10. Again, just really quick, 10% off any non-rush service that we provide. Just enter coupon code AST10 in the checkout window. So please take advantage of that. Medical school applicants this is prime time. MBA applicants, you're gearing up. Take advantage of this special offer for AST listeners only. It is nowhere on the site. One more time, 10% off any non-rush service purchased by June 30th. The discount may not be combined with any other discount offer at Accepted. The coupon code is A as in admissions, S as in straight, T as in talk, 10. AST10 is the coupon code. And then the request. If you found the show helpful, I have a favor to ask. Please share your perspective on iTunes. There's a link in the show notes to our iTunes page where you can leave a review. Doing so helps potential listeners find us and is very much appreciated. Or better yet, recommend the podcast to a friend. AST's audience has grown steadily, and I attribute that growth to one listener telling another and another and another. And if you have a question you would like me to answer or just want to post a share a comment on about the show, please do so in a comment at info.accepted.com/108. Again, that's info.accepted.com/108, or by sending an email to questions@accepted.com. Finally, if you're not yet a subscriber, you can subscribe either through iTunes, Stitcher, or Zoom. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I'm your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.